Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. We live in interesting and perplexing times. In an act of what an unaligned observer might well call political skullduggery, some anonymous person in the Vatican let it be publicly known to a Catholic magazine that Bishop Strickland of Tyler, Texas, might very well be asked by the Pope to resign his office. This set a series of dominoes falling, and they may continue to fall for some time. They may also produce consequences not wholly foreseen or even intended by the spin doctors within the Vatican, who presumably in the name of the Pope declared a psyops form of guerrilla warfare on conservative and faithful Catholics in the United States of America. We might want to ask, what was the intention behind this? Why was it done? What does it represent? Most difficult of all, what may be the outcome? As of the moment, late September 2023, Bishop Strickland has not, in fact, been asked to resign by the Pope. But what was the intention of putting it about that he might be? Perhaps both to test the waters amongst conservative Catholics in America, and at the same time provoke some kind of response. Bishop Strickland announced he would not preemptively fall upon his episcopal sword on the basis of a public hypothesis. Wounded Catholic voices have been raised in the blogosphere, repudiating schism but threatening resistance, presumably financial, and that is no small thing in itself. But aligned and unaligned commentators have noted in public a certain ethical and strategic incoherence in a Vatican policy that continues to shield, promote, and in the case of Marco Rupnik, rehabilitate serious sex offenders, while launching a campaign of psyops against an otherwise faithful and universally respected, competent, conservative Texan bishop. At its best, it's not a good look. At its worst, it suggests a disturbing and perhaps determined moral corruption and tone deafness to the consequent public distaste and disgust. But there's a history. It's not unconnected with the geopolitical mutual distrust between South America and its northern, more powerful neighbour. And during the years in which Francis has been Pope, there's been a history between the South American Pope and the North American faithful. To get a clearer sense of that history and a better understanding of the current political semiotics, I turned to Mark Lambert. Mark writes regularly for the Catholic Herald. He's a well-known and much-respected theologian blogger, and he has a significant following, as well as a network of friendships in North America. He joins me now. Mark, thank you for being here with me. I should offer a disclaimer and say, first of all, to our listeners that, above all, you and I are good friends. You and I podcast together anyway. We are of a like mind. But I'm very glad you've been able to join me on this particular podcast as we look at the political disruption that Bishop Strickland's case has caused, so that we can try and put it, first of all, into a broader context and then tease out some of the implications. Let me come to you first for context. Context is everything for so many issues. The relationship between Pope Francis and America is particularly fraught at the moment. But there might be a case for saying it began with an initiative from the Pope himself. Can you tell us a little bit about what appointments he might have been expected to have made and what appointments he did make? And then we'll go and look at the 2019 Bishops' Conference and look for the roots of what's happening in that particular event. So can you start off with what we might have expected to have happened in terms of appointments?
Well, in particular, two main ones spring to mind. One is Archbishop Gomez, who was leading the US Bishops' Conference, and Archbishop Chaput. Both of those were really obvious choices for Francis in lots of ways, because Gomez is of Hispanic descent, Chaput is a Native American descent, and they both would have been beautiful appointments in terms of diversity, you know, showing the diversity of the church. These are some of the things that Francis speaks to. But instead, he passed over those people. And Gomez was the most extraordinary one, because he went beneath Gomez and appointed McElroy as cardinal over his archbishop, which was an extraordinary move. And basically, all the appointments to the cardinalate that he's made, and we can go through them, Tobin, Supich, McElroy now, they're all of a very clear persuasion. And that persuasion is These are all people who've spoken against the teaching of the church, basically, and proposing a new vision of what it means to be Catholic.
So in terms of speaking against the church, I think you're talking about LGBT issues and issues of sexuality, almost a liberal Protestantization of the church. Is that right?
Obviously, they couch it in very careful language. It's not just about sexuality, but very interestingly, that is always a dimension of what they speak about. But there's also pro-life issues, which always seem to go hand in hand. I remember an exorcist telling me once that the two demons work very closely together. And basically, there's this legacy from Cardinal Bernardine of what he called his theology, which was the seamless garment theology, which a lot of these people, like Chaput is a real advocate of, this sort of demoting abortion in terms of the hierarchy and pushing up other life issues like poverty to be on an equal pegging.
Would it be true to say that this Bernardine seamless garment emphasis is a move from what you and I would call the metaphysical, good and evil, life and death, into the political, justice of the poor? Is that the axis that we're talking about?
Well, it's very astute of you to say so, Gavin. I think it is. And I think it's part a wider thing in the church from Vatican II, where we saw this movement towards, you know, a more practical kind of Catholicism, where it was much more about getting stuck in. You know, we had social justice and groups of justice and peace set up throughout parishes, throughout the Catholic Church. And I think all of us saw that as a really good thing. But it is interesting the way that it's developed in a lot of ways. I can remember a missionary priest saying to me once that it's very easy to get lost in the work, to forget the faith, and to forget that the work, the good works, come from the faith. So if we get that, if we get things in the right order, then we find ourselves automatically caring for people.
I think that's very helpful. I've just been reading John McCreevy's new book, Catholicism, A Global History from the Revolution to Pope Francis. And clarity and nuance are difficult to hold together. The more the clearer you are, the more you lose nuance, and vice versa. But it did seem to me that it is about this separation between what we might call metaphysics and the supernatural, with a very clear sense of the struggle between good and evil on the one hand, and the politicization of charity on the other. And you and I would say we would hope that there was a conjoining of these two things. But it seems to me that what we would call progressive Catholicism is, if not breaking them, at least trying to diminish the priority of what traditionalists would see as the importance of life and death issues of metaphysics. Is that the difference between these two groups of Americans that Francis, the ones he's promoted and the ones he hasn't promoted? The ones he haven't promoted were stronger on the traditional metaphysical issues that the church has always stood for in terms of pro-life. And the ones he did promote were the ones who preferenced the politicized agenda at the expense of the metaphysics. Is that fair to say that?
Very much so. I think you find that this politicization of the faith wraps itself around and becomes a priority to the expense of the metaphysical dimension.
What you're saying then is that you might have accepted Pope Francis to exercise the priorities he'd articulated so clearly about the importance of the indigenous and the marginalized, the non-white, the non-powerful, the non-privileged. And here you have two bishops who were perfect examples of that, but because of their adherence to traditional Catholic metaphysics, they were less appealing to him for promotion than the two he appointed. So let me just ask you to comment on that, because that would have set up a response, wouldn't it, amongst American Catholics? American Catholics would have seen these appointments. What would they have taken away from them in terms of their relationship with Rome once these appointments, the rather odd appointments, had been made?
Well, I think it's a very clear sign that Rome had a problem with orthodoxy in America, that there was a new boss in town. I remember the phrase that was reported when he stood on the loggia and said, "The carnival's over." Unfortunately, I think it would have hurt a lot of them. I think it would have hurt a lot of our American brethren to see these good men and the people that they're used to seeing championing the faith. You know, they were basically snubbed in a really obvious way. This hasn't just happened in America. Pope Francis has done this all over the world. But I think for us in the English-speaking world, where we see America, certainly in terms of my work in catechesis, we look to America for a lot of guidance. That might be because our bishops are quieter, would be a polite way of saying it.
They're more discreet.
They're not as effective as a lot of the work that goes on in the US. It's well known that there's a greater depth of faith in the United States, and I think you and I have seen that on our visits there together. So to see these men who were championing that then overlooked, and people who were seen as problematic being put above them, obviously has caused concern and a growing sense of dissatisfaction. And I think that's been manifest. It was reported a long while back that donations to Peter's Pence had dropped by like 33% from the US. And the US was the biggest contributor to Rome. So
right. And we're not talking about rad trads here, are we? We're talking about mainstream faithful Catholics. These are the people
definitely
who
middle of the road.
Feel themselves to have been repudiated by the priorities of appointment that the Vatican has chosen. So then if that's the context and they're scolding a bit and they're feeling a bit rejected and wondering about this new change of priority, a new epistemology almost, take us to 2019 and what happened at the US Bishops' Conference, because this sounds as though we're going to a funnel, aren't we? We've had the broad base and we're going to end up with Strickland at the sort of top of the triangle.
Yeah.
Let's get there by seeing what happened in 2019.
I think it's really interesting context because what we've been trying to say since we started in this conversation is that this isn't something that's happened completely out of the blue. This is something that's been building since Pope Francis took over as Pope. In 2019, there was a particularly clear example of what was going on when, really surprisingly, the US Nuncio made this announcement to the Bishops' Conference that he wanted the magisterium of Francis. What does that even mean? You know?
Well, but that's a key, isn't it? That's going to be the key to everything.
Exactly, exactly. He wanted to see this implemented. He wasn't happy. They weren't implementing it. So that was one thing that was really sort of shocking, really.
And he named the documents, didn't he, specifically?
Yeah, Amoris Laetitia, Laudato Si, and Evangelium Gaudium were the documents that were particularly mentioned, which, if you've read, I mean, Evangelii Gaudium is okay. It's got some good bits and some bad bits in it. Amoris Laetitia is probably the most controversial church document in living memory. And Laudato Si was largely criticised from experts in ecology as well as from people in the church. You know, it's not an area that we've got expertise in. Francis saw it as a development of, I mean, because Benedict XVI had written about the environment before, and there is that dimension that we are the caretakers and that we have to be responsible guardians. And
sure,
absolutely. And I wouldn't argue with that at all. But to write a whole encyclical where he engaged in all these polemics, some of them it didn't look like he'd fully understood what he was arguing about, and you know, although some people said he made good points in other bits. But basically, I mean, one of the leitmotifs of the papacy has been the verbosity of everything that he writes. It's very circular and it goes on and on and on, pages and pages and pages. It's very difficult to get a what is the Magisterium of Francis? You know, what actually is it all about? Those three documents are very different documents. Evangelii Gaudium, you've got this sort of disconnect. That's another thing that's run through the whole papacy, where you've got Pope Francis constantly saying that we mustn't proselytize, and lots of us are confused about what that means.
The problem is with language, isn't it? It's not only the fact that he doesn't speak English, but it's quite clear that the Pope takes certain words and has an understanding of them, which I would say isn't universally shared, but they're not defined properly. And so what we end up with is a degree of ambiguity that I think is probably one of the most problematic issues for observers. We're not altogether sure what he means, and different people are left grasping trying to interpret it. We're going to get back to the Magisterium of Francis towards the end. But essentially, so what you're saying is the nuncio arrived and told the Catholic bishops it was their job to implement the new magisterium summarized by these three documents and various other things? And how did they take it?
Well, I think there was shock, some degree of upset. There was a vote that was put forward about, and this is where it really, that argument came to the fore, and it surrounded the fact that you had Joe Biden as the president, who was extremely vehemently pro-abortion, and Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House, both of them really promoting abortion up to birth, and yet claiming that they were good Catholics. Joe Biden literally shaking his rosary beads at the camera. So there was this movement among the bishops to make a statement about the preeminence of abortion. You know, so this felt like an intervention from the nuncio or directly from Rome to tell the bishops to get in line with, you know, giving Holy Communion to people in a state of mortal sin, which is shocking to say the least. And so then we get into this situation where you've got this mental gymnastics going on with all these bishops, like the good bishops, trying desperately. Well, surely you can't mean that, exactly as you said, because of the impreciseness of the language, or, you know, there must be, you know, that kind of pope-splaining thing that we've seen, the phenomenon we've seen for the last 10 years, desperately sort of trying to make it fit. But some people really got it. One of them was Blaise Supich. Cardinal Blaise Supich stood up and basically said that he wanted that taken out. Abortion wasn't to be the preeminent life issue. And he was backed up by another bishop, Bishop McElroy, who is now Cardinal McElroy, who's the bishop who was promoted over Archbishop Gomez. McElroy, who's got a long list of problematic statements behind him before and since, basically, you know, stood up for it. And what they are pushing, this legacy, this theological legacy of Bishop Bernardine, Archbishop Bernardine, Cardinal Bernardine, which is the seamless, this idea of a seamless garment where there is no preeminent life issue, like poverty and famine and whatever. They're all equally important, which, you know, when you see it pushed forward in this way to sort of diminish the incredible damage being done by abortion, just shows a lack of understanding of the way that politics works. But it is a cloaking in political issues of the faith to try and manipulate the agenda, isn't it? You know, it seems very clear that that's what they're pushing at doing. So basically you had Supich and McElroy standing up, Archbishop Chaput and Bishop Strickland stood up and made very clear statements that it was retained as the preeminent issue. And there were other bishops as well, Paprocki and Aguila, and, you know, you can list them off, the usual sort of names, who stood up and defended it. And it was put through, the motion was put through with abortion being the preeminent life issue. But already at this point, you can see you've got the bishops working together, and it's like Pope Francis is telling them, well, you're all wrong. You know, like, how incredible is that? This from the nuncio is like saying, well, you lot don't know what the faith is, you know. And like, that's got no basis in canon law, or, you know, it's the opposite of what the catechism teaches. How are you to read this? Anyone watching it, you know, knew that that was a massive problem.
So essentially, this is where Strickland breaks cover to some extent. We have this certain heterodox-ish bishops promoting social and political theology at the expense of conventional metaphysics that has always been at the centre of the Catholic mind. And Strickland stands up and says, no, we're going with orthodox Catholic metaphysics, and repudiates or helps crystallise a view of the House of Bishops to repudiate what the Vatican, what the nuncio has come to do. This is not going to make Strickland the Vatican's favourite US bishop, is it? It's going to set the tone for what's happening now. So can we trace it back to that point, can't we?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. And I would imagine that, you know, all these people were being put on the hit list to some extent. But why is there this, from the Pope who's spoken about giving more power to the bishops, decentralisation of power, why is he getting involved on this sort of level? You know, it's very difficult to understand what exactly he's trying to do, don't you think?
Well, I think this certainly constitutes one of the contradictions that we find ourselves grappling with. I mean, later on, just in case we don't mention it, we're going to be dealing with the contradiction of a synodal process that was intended to be porous and open, democratic, inclusive, and offering restorative justice to society, which has suddenly been locked behind closed doors and become almost a secret society. So it's true that there is this odd constant contradiction at the heart of the Vatican program. What does Strickland do? Does he need to do? What happens between this meeting of the bishops in 2019 and the tweet that set off the investigation into his diocese in last spring?
I think Strickland pops up a couple more times. Definitely in 2023, there was an incident where, you know, you've got this Jesuit, Father James Martin, who basically his whole ministry seems to be about changing church teaching on homosexuality and promoting homosexuality. He's just released a book which is about Lazarus coming out when Jesus says, Lazarus coming out. What he means is, you know, it's mad.
It's so puerile as to be unbelievable. The idea that it takes revisionism to undreamt of heights that beyond our imagination. I mean, it's worth a Monty Python send-up, if only they were still there to do it. So Lazarus come out of the closet rather than the tomb. Did Strickland object to Martin?
Lots of bishops have, but in 2023, you know, Bishop Strickland actually took the action of tweeting about it, and he actually tweeted, "This blasphemy must stop." You know, he said, "God loves every person, even the most sinful, but saying sinful acts are compatible with the sacred heart of Jesus contradicts Christ's call to go and sin no more." So, and this is when Father James Martin said gay pride was compatible with the sacred heart of Jesus. For James Martin, everything is gay. Everything is gay.
He keeps on producing handwritten notes from Pope Francis commending him for his work and theological judgment, which
exactly
adds to the rich dynamic of what we're dealing with.
Yeah, the Pope's made personal time to meet him on several occasions, and he's given him a role as a Vatican media correspondent. So how can you not say that Pope Francis isn't pushing James Martin and James Martin's agenda? So you can see that there are these tensions building up in the church in America, and you can see very clearly what side of it Pope Francis is on. Where do the Orthodox go? Where do we go?
The paradox is that when Bishop Strickland issued this tweet that has effectively seemed to act as a declaration of war between his diocese and the Vatican, he was actually involved in an attempt to defend Pope Francis, because Patrick Coffin was claiming that the throne of St. Peter was empty, and a Jesuit whose name was Father Spitzer had withdrawn from Patrick Coffin and on the grounds he didn't want to be associated with Coffin's views. And Bishop Strickland was supporting Father Spitzer, saying one can't be associated with sedevacantism. But at the same time, he said, "I believe Pope Francis is the Pope, but it's time for me to say I reject his program of undermining the deposit of faith. Follow Jesus." With this tweet, he appears to have crossed the line, say the commentators. What happened then? How did the Vatican respond to that tweet?
There wasn't very much from the Vatican, but the Vatican Pope-splainers, I mean, where Peter is, went absolutely mad and was immediately calling for Strickland's removal. But again, where Peter is very much, they never report the other side, the people who are going against Francis in Germany or, you know, with the Synodal Way or any of these things. But they always come down heavy on those who are Orthodox. So it's always this manipulation away from what we would traditionally consider to be Catholic, and a movement in a more progressive direction, which is really interesting. But there really wasn't anything from the Vatican. I mean, I think a lot of people thought either brave or stupid thing for the Bishop of Tyler to do. I go back to when we were in America, you and I, last April, and everyone you spoke to, every group that we went to, they were all concerned about what was going on with the Pope. Everyone had questions, how do we remain Catholic and blah, 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 which I think we dealt with fairly well. But one of the ways that I was responding to it was saying, come on, you know that we've got good bishops in America. The first name at the top of the list was always Strickland. I just found that very moving, that they recognise the Good Shepherd. I mean, he's been Bishop of Tyler since 2012. He's a farmhand. You know, he grew up on a farm. He's not sophisticated. There's something really intensely Catholic about that, I think. And since he's taken over, Tyler has drawn a great Catholic community to it. So, and they've got more vocations per capita than lots of much bigger dioceses. And they're doing really well financially because, you know, Strickland gets the support of good Catholics because he's straightforward. We've seen that with the letters that he's been writing about his position. And what have they done? They've just basically said, reinforced Catholic teaching on all these points. And there were, you know, I don't know if you saw, I did a big blog where someone from where Peter is or something challenged me to say, where has Pope Francis spoken about these issues? You know, the seven issues that Tyler laid, that the Bishop of Tyler laid out in his apostolic letter. And I basically went through them, and you can give dozens and dozens of examples in the Instrumentum Laboris. So where the women deacons and everything is trans and LGBT and one thing another. So, you know, you, any one of these issues, take, for example, the Eucharist. Strickland was very clear about what the church teaches on the Eucharist and just quoting straight out of the catechism. But there's very clearly a move towards open table theology in the Magisterium of Francis, if you like, you know, where he's, you know, he's even joked about giving Holy Communion to a Jewish lady who presented herself. And he directly undermined Archbishop Cordiglione by having Nancy Pelosi, after Cordiglione had banned Nancy Pelosi or said that it would be in her best interest not to receive the sacrament publicly, he invited her to the Vatican and she received Holy Communion. So what a mess, eh? So
well, except it is. It is beginning to be clear, isn't it? Because the public perception of Bishop Strickland's diocese is it's well-run, well-financed, the extraordinary phenomenon of a larger growth in vocations. And the Vatican's response to his tweet was to launch an investigation into the way the diocese was run. That looks to everyone more like an act of vengeance than it does of good administrative housekeeping. Is that how it was seen in America, do you think?
Definitely, definitely. So there's this big thing where everyone is going to Strickland. All the people asking for comment are going to Strickland for comment. If you see any of the interviews that he's done with Catholics for Catholics, and, you know, he's never frightened. He's been on Church Militant. And, you know, Church Militant is often criticised for being very down on the bishops, but they do an awful lot of good journalism. And the bishops keep well away. There are only two Paprocki's been on there, but Strickland's been on there a few times. You know, he's not frightened of talking to everyone. Surely that's Catholic, isn't it? Because we're all Catholics. You know, I always remember C.S. Lewis talking about Catholicism. I loved his analogy of Catholicism as a jungle that it's easy to get lost in. But the real idea of the church is one of immense diversity and the fact that we're all being called to be together. And there are lots of different people with lots of different... What we've got is the profession of faith. That's what we've got, is fidelity to Christ and to the deposit of faith that was left to us by the apostles. And if we haven't got that, that unity dissipates. And that's what we're seeing happening now. We're seeing an extremely worrying factionalization being driven, unfortunately, by the Pope and whoever surrounds him. It's trying to undo the glue that binds this incredible unity together. I don't think for a minute it will succeed, but it's horrible to watch it taking place, isn't it?
Let me ask you then about the way in which pressure's been put on Strickland, because, of course, he hasn't been asked to resign. What happened instead was that somebody in the Vatican spoke to the pillar and said that there was a real possibility he might be asked to resign, which is a cheap way of testing the temperature, isn't it? And then, of course, immediately everyone knows that he might be asked. In terms of canon law, we've seen other bishops resign because the Pope brought pressure on. What's the position of a bishop vis-a-vis the Pope?
When I did theology, canon law was my least loved subject. But I'm not a canonist by any stretch of the imagination, but the way that I understand it is that they need a reason to remove him. So there needs to be some malfeasance, some impropriety of some nature, whether that be financial or... And I just can't see how they're going to pin it on him. You know, so I think they can ask him to resign, but it seems from what he's put out publicly that he said no, he's been given a mandate from Pope Benedict XVI, who made him a bishop, and he's going to see that mandate through. So we've lost this sense that the bishops, that there's a shared responsibility in the episcopacy. Again, it's one of the things that Pope Francis, you know, in his words, has tried to emphasize, this idea that he's the Bishop of Rome. He's withdrawn from being called the Pope in lots of respects and just wanted to be seen as the Bishop of Rome, one of the brother bishops. And I do wonder if one of the results of this extraordinary papacy is going to be a move of the church back towards conciliarism and away from the sort of ultramonetist tendencies that came out of Vatican I.
So it's about power and public opinion. The paradox is that Pope Francis appears to have been wanting to energize public opinion in terms of the voice, discovering the voice of the faithful. And he's wanted to do that in order to mandate a change in the priority of Catholic ethics. But it's just possible that he may energize the voice of the faithful in an entirely different way, as you say, and produce a conciliarism that energizes the roots of lay opinion in a way that's got nothing to do with ethics, but everything to do with the exercise of power and the centralizing of authority. I mean, it would be a very strange paradox if the Pope set out to reduce the centralizing of authority because he wanted to produce a different ethical climate, but in the end succeeded because there was a sense of repudiation of what people saw as the magisterium of Francis in the way he's been presented. In other words, it's almost as if by presenting it in the way that they have, they're inviting a response, and the response may be repudiation.
I can't wait to see what happens, really. And what are they going to do? If they do manage to remove him, he's just going to be another bishop without mandate. You know, he'll still be a bishop. And, from what we know of America, he'll be able to go around raising funds and go to all the different gatherings that there are and speak, and just basically it'd be a massive, massive problem for Pope Francis and the Vatican.
I'm sure that's what they're trying to work out at the moment, whether it's going to cause them more trouble to lean on him, dislodge him, and then have him as a kind of Texan Vigano, free to say what he wants and to gather the faithful to them. So, I mean, one of the things I've heard some of the more traditional Catholics say in their podcasts is to warn the Vatican that if they attack Bishop Tyler, what they will do is they will diminish the funding that they receive even further. And that's actually a serious problem because there really is a funding crisis. So a whole series of dioceses are being invited to make very serious cuts in their overheads. But at the same time, it will increase resistance. Now, they don't spell out what their resistance is going to be, but whatever else it is, it's going to be another contradiction to our understanding of Catholicity. Clearly short of schism, you can't have schism if you're a Catholic. But the very idea of resistance to the centre is going to take up energy and really rather poison the well of our collegiality. So they've got to decide whether or not they go the full hog and execute him in terms of his episcopacy, or whether they leave him in place, having not been dislodged as a bishop, and therefore with more power morally. I imagine there are strategists in the Vatican scratching their heads thinking, this is going to work badly for us whichever way we go.
Well, and let me put a third option, which is the traditional Catholic option, which is that you promote them to Rome. This is how we ended up with Cardinal Roche in the Dicastery for Liturgy. Is because when they fail, what tends to happen is they get promoted to Rome and given some, you know, nonsensical job pushing a book around or whatever, and that's how they deal with it. And you can see how in this case that would be quite a clever thing to do, actually, you know, to give him a job in Rome. And, you know, I've always felt that the church fails with this quite often. You know, you can see what his strengths are as a good manager. What are you trying to do? You're trying to see where people's strengths are and put them in a position where that would work best for your organization, you know. And all right, perhaps that's a bit of a secular approach, but I don't understand how they can see Joseph Strickland as a problem for the Catholic Church. It really is extraordinary. I can see how it's a problem for Francis, for Pope Francis, and the fact that the more aggressively he goes after individuals, you know, like Cardinal Roche, obviously reading where Peter is, and even to the point where sort of making statements on there and making it almost the Magisterium of Francis or whatever. It's absolutely bizarre times that we live in. And all that I see it doing, all of this, is diminishing the authority of the church and the authority of the Pope. because I hear every day from people who are saying, I'm going to leave the church, and, you know, have to have that conversation with them. You know, where else would you go? Because the church has got, you know, the Catholic Church has got the message of eternal life. But I mean, there's a twofold problem. One is the fact that it puts people off becoming Catholic, because all of our arguments about authority are based on, when you think about Francisine and his hermeneutic of rupture, and you think about the very careful way Pope Benedict spoke and Pope John Paul, and you've just got the opposite. You've just got the opposite in this man. And it's a massive problem for us.
Let me put another side to this, because a number of people have suggested, look, you need to be careful not to become too emotionally engaged, because partly by doing that, you give more power to those people you see as your theological opponents. But if Francis did with the synodal process what he did with the Amazonian Synod, we don't think it should have been set up. We found it profoundly offensive in terms of Pachamama. But in the end, he made a decision not to put his weight behind what it stood for. If nothing happens to Bishop Tyler, if the synodal process that takes place in the autumn doesn't emerge with any papal imprimatur, let's say he dies, what will he have done? He won't have changed anything. Aren't we finding ourselves over-energized by threat rather than substance? We're not wrong in that the threat could become substance. My fear, as yours is too, is that they intend it to be, and that's what the synodal process has done. But so far, I think the one piece of hope that I have is the way in which he withdrew from placing his weight behind the Amazonian Synod, because that was, you know, that was so problematic in terms of indigenous religion, idolatry, Pachamama, a complete misreading of the South American scene, the celebration of a bishop who hasn't baptized anybody in his life. But he did withdraw. He didn't do it. So are we responding too emotionally to something that hasn't happened yet because we're dealing with a threat rather than with action?
I think that Quareda and Amazonia, which was the apostle, I thought was really good. One of them. It was actually, you know, in the end, he ended up just reaffirming church teaching and it all came to nothing. So yeah. Please God, that's what's going to happen here. I really, you know, and I can really see that happening, that it's all this fuss and bluster and nothing will come out of it. And he's already said, hasn't he? Was it last week he said that he made a statement saying that he knows it's completely irrelevant to everyone. Bizarrely that, he would sort of say that and asking the journalist to be on his side. It's like he recognises that there's massive pushback already before he's even started. Let's pray for that outcome. But from my point of view, I still think it's important that we discuss it and that we are honest about the problems and how we see them, because I think it's important that we get it out there that this is causing, on the ground level, those of us involved in catechesis see it. And our parish priests in the confessional see the result of the confusion that's been caused by a lot of this chat. And attacking good bishops, it couldn't get much worse than that, could it?
I think it's our job to defend good bishops, and you and I have done our very best to use our talents to both defend the magisterium of the church and to defend the bishops. But it just does occur to me, this is me at my most optimistic, I had to go on the public media and give a message of hope for Catholicism. And I'm just wondering if I might not even be right. It just occurs to me that ambiguity cuts both ways. And what we may have found is that the prevailing dynamic of Francis's period as Pope has been an ambiguity which invites people to decide what it is that matters to them most. And if he doesn't put his weight behind the progressive agenda built in to the synodal process, all he will have done is to promote some people that we don't think very much of because they don't have a good record in terms of looking after the victims of sex abuse. They don't have a good record in terms of articulating the best focused notion of a Catholic metaphysic, and they may do a bit of damage in terms of public reputation. But the substance of being a Catholic hasn't been changed yet. If we come out with that, then we might weather the present storm. Is that a reasonable... I hate to use the word optimism because we're not talking about optimism. We're really talking about the exercise of faith, the promise of the protection of the Holy Spirit to guard the bark of the church.
Definitely. I think that that is the case, that the faith has always been carried forward by the people, by the faithful, irrespective of whatever is going on in Rome. And I think when we've got a good pope, that's absolutely fantastic. Perhaps we've been spoilt in the last... I mean, it's just a drop in the water in terms of time, isn't it, for the papacy as well. And we're seeing all these secular problems that we recognise in society being played out in microcosm within the church. And in a way, I suppose that's appropriate. Let's test everything and hold on to what's good. So, yeah, we should talk about these things. We should talk. I suppose my problem with the whole thing is just the ambiguity, really. I remember at the beginning of it all, someone said he signals right and turns left, and it's that he never seems to clarify what he actually means. So please God, he is a faithful son of the church as he claims to be. So when you say the worst that he's done is promote people with a dodgy reputation, that's what really bothers me. I don't think you can look at that. I don't think you can look at the kind of people that he's put into the positions that he's put them in and ignore the fact that that is a huge problem. I'm not a clergyman. I'm not a great theologian or anything like that, but I'm just giving you the Catholic on the ground sort of position, if you like. So someone who really believes it and knows a lot of Catholics and, you know, has sort of been involved in the church in a really strong way all my life. It really is problematic that no one seems prepared to say no to him when he wants to put someone with a record of abuse in a high position, or someone who doesn't seem to have any competence like Fernandez in charge of the dicastery for the Congregation of the Faith. You know, the way that he ignores Cardinal Zen, the deal that he's done with China, these things, you know, they are problematic for the church. They're costing souls. If all of our bishops were Tyler, if all of our bishops were Strickland, we'd be in such a better place, because all Strickland does is he just teaches the faith. It's the same faith that we recognize. He's happy to engage in issues. So he's articulate in explaining it in terms of the vicissitudes of modern life. He's not afraid to engage with those dynamics and to have those conversations, but he's very clear. He states it very simply and with great love. That's what we need. We need to, when we ask for bread, we need to be given bread, don't we? You know,
Mark, you talked about the need for Catholics on the ground who are well-informed and who hold the faith and who bring some clarity to the conversation. I think the only correction I want to make is I think we want to pray that the Pope signals left but turns right in terms of rather than signaling right and turning left. If right in this case is anti-progressive and celebrates the faith that we've always had. Mark Lambert, thank you very much for spending this time together. I hope that what we've offered is a conversation that other people can join in and can be continued. And I look forward to an opportunity maybe in 12 months' time when we can come back and discover that perhaps the whole plots that we've seen to change the faith of the church haven't in fact come to anything. But for that, we'll have to wait and see our prayers. Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin. It's always a great pleasure.